As Steve Brule said, an orgy is no fun if nobody wants to do it with you.
Well, howdy, folks. It's Friday, and we are drunk and retired.
And I'm like, why is it asking for my password? This seems weird.
Oh, that's just the Russian hackers.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Not surprised.
Your friendly neighborhood Ukrainian.
Oh, that's good stuff. But yeah, so we are recording now. Just to kind of.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
This we is have a our, special guest.
Yes, we do. You want to say hi?
Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Sean Mouton. I also live in Texas with these fools.
but the distance between us is very still grasped. Very, very, very
great.
Great.
You know, they say that because Texas is such a large place that driving long distances is like commonplace. But still, we rarely actually see each other because you live all the way out in Driftwood? No. What's the other thing? Dripping Springs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're in the backyard of Jester King, right?
Yep.
You're
in
like,
between them and all the other booze producers out here.
Now, is it true that the way they get that like that sour taste to their beers is they actually just dip Sean in their vat?
Well, it's not specifically me.
Right.
It's just random Sean's.
Just random Sean's.
Yeah. So little known fact, if you go out there and when they check your ID, if it says Sean, there's like a, I don't know, whatever chance it is, if they need more yeast or bacteria, that they'll go and dip you in a vat during the tour.
I mean, you're contributing to your local economy, Sean, and I think that is the yeast you could do.
Hey!
It is maybe not quite the yeast, but definitely pretty close.
Now, Sean, before we just get on to general ramblings, our viewers, I should say our listeners, can't see your amazing background. So we're on a Zoom call because that's how you podcast these days. And Sean has a giant burning tire fire behind him. I guess as opposed to a not burning tire fire. I feel like there was some redundancy in that. But anyway, so Sean, do you want to talk a little bit about why you have a burning tire fire behind you?
I have a burning tire fire behind me because my coworker and your friend Jerry Rose turned the GIF into an MP4.
Hey.
Let's see, about 5 years ago, I was working for a fintech startup here in town with some mutual friends of ours, and it was just a very broken work environment and an incredibly broken tech environment. And in order to cope, we used gallows humor and self-deprecation. And I came out of it with a domain, tirefy.re, and a website, Tirefire, that we all contribute to. Terrible jokes and I mean, they're just really bad jokes. That's pretty much it.
Yep, that sounds about right. We'll provide a link to that. It's kind of fun to explore it. We even built a web ring, which it's all done with like static content using Jekyll. And if you've ever tried to do anything usefully dynamic inside of Jekyll, you will absolutely hate yourself. You know, sometimes its lists start at 0 and sometimes its lists start at 1. So when you want to move back and forth between values in a list, it can be interesting.
And also, we do have CDCI on it. It is probably one of the best tests. That's the weird part, because it echoes true. I don't know why it doesn't work. It's kind of weird.
I think I forced a passing test. The CICD is like everything else on this site. It's designed to be more than partially bad.
So what's going on? I saw that CoreOS is officially end of life as of a day or two ago.
Mm-hmm. Pour one out for the immutable OS.
Yep. Well, so it wasn't initially because CoreOS went EOL yesterday or the day before. It was yesterday. It was the 26th. Last Friday. So, as some people may know, some people may not, but every Friday I stream with Red Hatters on the IBM, developer Twitch channel. And one of the first things they ever showed me, this was maybe 2-3 months ago now, just before the pandemic hit and we all got locked down, was something called Silverwood.
That's, mm-hmm. That's the boom boom times in the podcast boom parlance. Times.
Yeah. Yeah. There okay. You go. His name is Brian Tanis. He shared a screen, and there's just some like weirdness to it. And he was like, "Yeah, this is Silverblue." And I'm like, "What the fuck is Silverblue? Never heard of this before." And he's like, "Oh, it's another Fedora distro." And I'm like, "Wait, how many distros does Red Hat have?" So we finally sat down and went through all the different distros of Red Hat. And there's a running joke internally at Red Hat, which is Red Hat isn't a Linux Linux company. They're a Linux distribution company because of all the different distributions they have, right? And all the different spurs, the way the CentOS.
That's what passes as a joke in Red Hat?
I mean, they're IBM now. What can I say?
All right.
You know, if you want to add an extra dad mention to this, you could say that they're not actually a Linux distribution company. They're a Linux distribution suppression company because of how many distributions get conceived of and then shut down before they leave the gates.
Oh. So they're the Google of Linux.
Oh.
Oh. If you think they kill products in the open, just imagine what happens behind the scenes.
Oh, great. So Silverblue. What is Silverblue? I was curious. I didn't have an opportunity, and I finally got to sit down and play with it. So it is an immutable operating system, just like what CoreOS was and now Fedora CoreOS is.
Wait, hang on. Slow down. So CoreOS is EOL'd, but there's another CoreOS that's not EOL'd?
No. Turns out there's CoreOS, which was the birth of all this. Then Red Hat came out with something called Atomic.
Right. I remember Atomic, yeah.
And that's becoming EOL'd also. And then Fedora CoreOS is now the next generation of Atomic that has taken things from original CoreOS and Atomic to build the next thing. And Fedora CoreOS is the upstream, while Red Hat CoreOS is the basically OpenShift hypervisor, for lack of a better term. Right. That's what it's designed to do. Like, so CoreOS is for running immutable operating systems running containers, while Red Hat CoreOS is the supported operating system that OpenShift specifically is designed to run on. So take this.
CoreOS is dead. Long live the CoreOS.
Exactly. So one of the biggest things about it for me is that I have many friends who use a lot of my digital media, and my machine, which is, as we can see on the Zoom, but y'all can't hear on the audio, is behind me. I have touched that machine so many times that I've realized that it's just gotten crusty, right? And I was thinking about this as I was trying to think of a way to get all the data off of it to be able to reinstall the OS, blah, blah, blah. And then I realized that immutable operating systems is the answer to what I'm trying to do. so I don't fuck with it, right? So I don't fuck with it, right? Like, it goes back to the CoreOS.
Paul's asking that question as somebody who actually ran CoreOS in the past. I've played with it.
I guess the reason I'm like, is it? Because it just means that you're futzing with a non-immutable portion of that OS, right? And so, like, things like the kernel and everything might be immutable, mm-hmm. or maybe read-only is the better term, since mm-hmm. if it's actually running, it's mutating in memory. But that's kind of another rat hole that we don't need to go down. You're going to be running something that is mutable, right? And that something is going to be containers. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have a bunch of garbage containers instead of a bunch of garbage things in opt or installed by RPM or DNF or whatever we're supposed to be using these days. Is it DNF?
So that's a whole nother spur of a conversation.
All right. Well, let's not go there.
Yeah. But what I want to go back to the reason why this specific box is I purposely told myself not to mess with it. Right. And over time I just have. And also I was thinking that because it's FreeBSD and it's a ZFS box, also getting ZFS to work with Fedora CoreOS is actually a pretty big jump. That's a different conversation. What I'm trying to get at is the version of Plex specifically that runs on this box is really, really old. And I thought I might be able to get some wins out of running Plex in a container and be able to have it be able to be iterative so much faster, because if some new version comes out, I just pull down the new container and I restart the service and it's good to go.
Right, but that's just running an application in a container. That's not necessarily running an immutable operating system.
But then I don't touch anything else. And then because it forces me not to, it will not allow me to, like, even if I'm like, oh, I'm just going to spin up a VM real quick just to fuck around for a little while. No, I can't even do that. Like, I force myself to sit in, like, sit up straight, if you will, and I cannot go off the rails. Unlike this FreeBSD box, which, by the way, honestly, not a lot of people know how to use FreeBSD or Beehive for that matter. And for me to sit on and fucks around with it on that to get it working, that was a lot of work. And I got nothing out of it apart from a box that if I touch it the wrong way, it's possible it could go down. Right.
I wonder how similar of an experience you will feel like it was after you switch the underlying OS to CoreOS and have Plex running on a container versus like just using either, you know, a regular Fedora headless or CentOS as the host and run Plex and Docker. Because Plex and Docker is like relatively easy.
Yeah.
So I guess I went through a similar path a few years ago. And I was running FreeBSD with ZFS and had a big Z pool of terabibbles of video and Linux ISOs and stuff. And when Ubuntu brought out ZFS support, I set up an Ubuntu box, plugged my drives in and did zpool import, and all my data showed up. And then I wrote systemd unit files or whatever they're called to run Plex in a container, and a few other things, even like Chrome and a few other things in a container. So I never mess with the OS on that box anyway. Without needing to go and learn a whole new paradigm of operating system, right? Because I have like 4 or 5 Ubuntu boxes in my house. And so I treat them all like I upgrade them the same way. I run the same versions of things on them, etc. It's just that box, I don't ever really run anything in like user space or anything. I run things in Docker containers.
But isn't the FreeBSD or the ZFS integration in user space? Or am I wrong on that? Is it actually?
You do app you apt install it and it like recompiles stuff and
it builds it into the kernel. Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah.
Because that was actually one of the other conversations I've had, which is with the RPM OS tree. So let's go into that. So the best analogy I heard, which was the immutable operating system, is the idea of kind of like Chrome OS, right? You get a Chromebook and you can jailbreak it if you want, but as long as you use default Chrome OS, it will work on your Chromebook. And it's super, super like stable for what it is. And if there's an update, it actually copies the update into a new partition. And then when you reboot, it boots off of that and still keeps that around. And the same thing with OS tree. It just keeps things, and you can actually, it's a lot like Git. You can actually just tag versions. So if you want to roll back because you're doing something. Now, that's awesome. In the case of like iPhones or OS tree or Chromebooks, take it one step farther and start thinking about your server that way, right? Like that's the kind of where I'm budding all this from.
Yeah. So I think for when you're talking at that, like at a level where you have like a fleet of servers, and being able to do very specific updates, rollbacks and stuff, and having that immutable OS, that does start to become interesting and very useful. I'm not sure you're going to get a lot of value out of it doing it for a one-off machine at home. Unless you're like specifically doing it to learn a thing, great. But if you're specifically doing it to learn a thing, you've like put a line in the sand to say, not only am I learning this thing, but I'm going to be using this thing for the next 4 or 5 years. Because that's probably how long you're going to want to run something like this for before you go back. So like, do you want to learn a new thing at the same time you're making a decision about longer term, how you're going to be running things at home? Or do you want to be like, hey, I already run a bunch of this, whatever Linux distro, I'm going to use that, keep things consistent, and I'll learn Silver Blue or Silver Light or whatever it is as like a project. I'll do some stuff on it and see how we go. So, I mean, when I did my box, I was all for running like Kubernetes, which was still super immature at the time. I actually looked at doing CoreOS. I looked at a bunch of stuff. And at the end of the day, I'm like, I already know Ubuntu. Ubuntu does me well. Ubuntu has really good ZFS support. So I'm just going to stick with that path.
Makes sense.
And then I was like, I'll buy some cheap machines and run a Kubernetes cluster as like a side project, which I never ended up doing.
The other thing is that with if you get it running on Plex and Docker on a OS that you understand well, then you have Plex running. And then you can learn the thing. And if you find that it's long-term viable, then moving it over is not heavyweight.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I guess the most important thing for that box to be stable is the ZFS, right? So maybe what you want to be doing is running a server that's more focused at just being the ZFS host, and then having a secondary server or something that is then going to run your userLAN stuff, and maybe that's in a VM running on that server, so that you have access to like the raw drive without having to go through like a NFS share or a Samba share or Samba share.
Yeah, it's true. The core problem that I have is that I still have the directory structure that I had for a NAS that I had almost 10 years ago on it, which is completely wrong. And with everything
JJ, that I could be... If you want to make a Plex omelet, you're going to have to break some eggs.
I know, it's true. And I just don't want to touch it. I just don't want to touch it. But and also, like, doing upgrades on FreeBSD are probably one of the most, like, major version bumps if you've ever gone through, like, the FreeBSD update and upgrade process.
Just make world, right?
It is honestly one of the most... it's too black boxy, right?
Yeah.
Like you see a bunch of dots go by and you see a bunch of patches hit and you're like, oh God, what's going on? Oh God.
Yeah, but okay. Like I've been doing like an Ubuntu upgrade. You run do release upgrade and you like walk away and you come back and it's probably the new version.
But the amount of like people that, using right? Ubuntu compared to FreeBSD is orders of magnitude different, right? And as much as I love being like the one-off weird guy in the corner, like I chose an operating system that originally I learned on and I absolutely adore. Like I have always loved FreeBSD.
So just, I actually think there's a correlation mm-hmm. between DevOps thought leaders and people who learned on FreeBSD. Because a number of DevOps thought leaders that talk about working on the ports tree and doing stuff like that is actually surprisingly high. I totally learned on FreeBSD as well. That was my first real Unix. Well, actually, there was some HPUCs and stuff at school, but I don't count that.
Well, you had access to FreeBSD, right? Like that was the whole point. It was an actual Unix operating system that you could actually get your hands on and not have to borrow someone else's time somewhere.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Long story short, don't do it.
Don't do it. That's what I'm saying. Don't do it. Yeah. Or don't do it for your file share system.
Yeah.
Like deal with the ZFS getting off FreeBSD problem as something different to learning about.
Any chance either of you have a 10 or 15 terabyte machine just sitting in the corner that I can export a bunch of data to for a little while so I can clean up this machine and send it back? Just
throw it out there.
You know, I think the appropriate way to do that is you buy a NAS, you copy the data, reformat, copy the data back, and then you send that NAS back and say it didn't work.
Keep the hard drive. Yeah, no, but you can keep the hard drives though, because you can't send hard drives back. But that actually might work. That actually might
give
work
you your really money back if you do that.
That actually might work out really, really well. Just now,
I'm not telling you to do something dodgy, but you know.
No, it's not a horrible idea.
Now, before we move on from that topic, is Fedora, CoreOS, SilverLake, do they use, what do they use for the actual like user land containers? Are they using Flatpak or are they using, what's the Ubuntu LXD thing?
Snap.
Yeah. Or are they doing yet their own thing?
So that goes back to the OS tree, RPM OS tree, Flatpak, and Snaps. So OS tree is what you get, like the core, the Chrome OS version. RPM OS tree allows you to inject an RPM into your OS tree, so you can do an old RPM install of something you want, but then you have your own fork of the OS tree with something already put inside of it. Now, the official Red Hat, right? So if you want to put like Vim on everything, right? You just do RPM OS tree Vim and it'll always be there for you, okay. Right? Inside the OS tree. Now, if you want to install something like Chrome, for instance, Chrome is actually a really hard thing to install. It's not just a Flatpak. It's not just a Snap. There's a lot of things underneath Chrome that you have to do an RPM OS tree to install. And then you have Chrome built into your OS from then on. Luckily, because of the way it's written, it does updates pretty regularly, and you actually have to reboot your machine because it recompiles the OS tree when it does the upgrade. So that's the only way to get rid of that really annoying, like, you've got a new, you need a new version of Chrome, blah, 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 to make that happen. Hang on, okay. Almost done.
Okay.
Now, if you wanted to install something like, and this is what I did during my stream, OpenTTD, which is that game, the little transport game, right? Mm-hmm. You use something like a Flatpak to install that, which is a very simple kind of, you use a Flatpak hub basically, and you mm-hmm. just do flat install or Flatpak install, whatever it is. And it just comes in and it lives just there inside the user space in its own little entity underneath in your home directory. And that's important because the idea with OS tree is that in theory, which it's not possible right now because it's not a lot of adoption, but in theory, you could reboot your machine. And because of the way the partitions are set up, you could boot yourself into Ubuntu and still have your home directory and all your other structure underneath it. Or you could boot yourself into Slackware if you wanted to, or whatever, if they had an OS tree version, if that makes sense. Did I make too much of a jump there? The whole point of immutable infrastructure or immutable operating systems is that you can rip out the underpinnings of the OS, still have your functioning machine, and be able to reboot into something different. Make sense?
I mean, it sort of does, but then you go to, like, are they the same kernel version? Are the system calls the same? Like, there's a lot of other things that go into making sure a binary exactly.
That's what the Flatpaks are for. The Flatpaks take that part problem away. So you could just, like, your base operating system switch out when you need to.
So the Flatpaks bring their own kernel?
No. So they live in their own kind of, like, user land space.
Yeah.
In essence, it's a container. It's a container.
Yeah, I know. I mean, they are a container, yes.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, there's still, I mean, for the most part, yes, a container is a container. But I have in the past had a container that would run on Ubuntu and not Red Hat and vice versa.
Well, don't run 804 happen. Don't run 804 Ubuntu, man. That's your problem.
Yeah. No, it's not. We went through this at your former employer, JJ. The thing that you need to do in order to build what you're talking about, a container or a truth that's genuinely portable, is you have to have a very clear picture of what your external dependencies are. Mm. And if something, like if you're not pulling in glibc into the container and you're depending on the root, if to Paul's point, if you haven't compiled in kernel support for, some sharing operation, then your container is going to try and place something, in a location, and whatever the fetcher isn't going to get it. And it's going to stack trace y'all to hell. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's not something like that to function properly is great. But as Steve Brühl said, an orgy is no fun if nobody wants to do it with you. Right, like the thing that you need in order to properly develop a feature set like that is to have active users who are forcing you to encounter the edge cases and deal with them appropriately, because you're always going to run into differences.
Yeah, I'm totally for the being able to immutably run and upgrade your operating system using effectively the Chrome sandboxes, right? I assume the Red Hat OS tree stuff is still based on the Chrome sandboxes, like Core OS was.
I think so.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm all for that. But then when you start talking about changing out different OSs, like, first of all, there's no real world use case there. No one is really wanting to, like, oh, I'm just going to, like, uplift my entire fleet.
Freedom.
Yeah,
that is the real world. It's freedom to not be tied down.
You know what? I'm going to give you the sixth freedom right now. The freedom to go F yourself.
So very important and often forgotten.
Absolutely. Speaking of very important but oft forgotten things, how do you do breakfast? Do you eat breakfast? Mm. Do you not eat breakfast? Are you a skip breakfast, or as the cool kids call it, intermittent fasting person?
Are you JJ, asking me or me, JJ in this case?
JJ, I'm asking. We'll start with JJ.
Oh my God. JJ's holding up a fucking rock star. Oh, wait, this is after dark, right? I can say.
Yeah, no,
you can now.
I live and breathe through rock stars. So if you've ever seen me on the road, when I was on the road, you could tell when I haven't had my rock stars. because I'm just slow. Well, I'm just slow in general, but I'm really slow when I haven't had my energy drinks. I've lived and breathed off these for years. I know it's bad for me, and it's how I start my day. Like, some people drink a lot of coffee, right? And I went down a coffee track I was a Starbucks barista for a long time, right? So I lived and breathed the coffee world for a while, but Rockstar's the amount of actual vitamins that they put into it too. My body's gotten so used to them that I basically, if I don't have them, I'm useless. So that's my breakfast, a Rockstar.
Did you know that they make multivitamins?
Oh no, I take those too. So that's my breakfast.
Cool. That's your breakfast, Sean. Yeah. Wow, what does your breakfast look like?
If I have breakfast during the week, it's blended up fruits and veggies. Saturday and Sunday.
You're a green smoothie kind of guy?
I don't exclusively have green smoothies, but I will have green smoothies. I don't like having the same thing all the time.
Right.
So I will definitely not have a green smoothie every morning in the week. I'll have, coconut and cinnamon and whatever else I decide to throw in there. But it's also the way that I make sure that we don't throw away any produce. Because
that's clever.
Very picky eaters in the house.
Right.
Now I will say though.
But Saturday and Sunday are eggs and bacon.
Yeah, so Saturday and Sunday breakfast, completely different conversation.
So does that mean, Sean, you end up having like a turnip smoothie because that's what produce you have left in the house, or do you draw the line?
It's all onions. Why is it all onions?
It hasn't happened yet.
All right.
Thoughts and prayers.
So I'm part of the bread making culture, as most of nerds are nowadays. But one of the things,
pre boom boom time bread baker, yes, or post boom boom time?
I was doing it for a handful of years before it. You can actually go back in my Twitter feed and you'll see me taking pictures of it.
All right. You were baking bread before it was cool.
I'm OG, man. I'm OG. What can I say?
Do you do sourdough or do you do
bread yeasted? My family does not like sourdough. Whatever. So the thing that my family's fallen in love with is French toast. Because of the bread, how much bread I make, inevitably it goes stale. And it turns out French toast, very simple French toast. Like, if you read the Martha Stewart recipes, you go through all that stuff. There's just so much fucking sugar in that stuff. It just goes above and beyond anything you can, like, it's basically dessert.
I feel like American breakfast is dessert.
As a Cajun,
yeah,
my culture came up with pan perdue, and yes. I'm offended
that it's a dessert.
No, I mean I'm aware that there is a greater culture of French toast, but that's kind of like Chinese food in America, uh-huh. or fortune cookies. Like, it's as Chinese as apple pie.
Nice.
French toast is it's pretty French actually, even with all the sugar.
All you need is a little bit of milk, handful of eggs, some cinnamon, and stale bread.
Cinnamon?
Yeah.
And a little all bit of JJ's family needs.
And a little bit of vanilla extract. And that's all you need. And you don't add any extra sugar. You don't do that.
You don't do powdered sugar on top?
Well,
and maple syrup?
No. The powdered sugar, that's a deal breaker for my daughter. She will not eat it unless she has like a mountain of it on top of it. But
you need to introduce her to Steams. Comes in a yellow can. It's pure cane syrup.
Oh, yeah.
And it will probably blow her mind.
Oh, okay. All right. Steams.
My grandpa used to carry his lunch to work in a big old Steams can when he rode the train into New Orleans for work. It's a very Cajun, extremely unhealthy breakfast enhancement.
All right. So CZ, you have not answered your own question.
Well, I was just waiting for somebody to ask.
Hey.
So I am fairly habitually a skip breakfast person, not for faux health reasons such as intermittent fasting, but just because I'm lazy. So my usual thing is around sort of 11, 11:30, I start thinking about lunch. And so I'll often have an early lunch that will look breakfasty. So I'll do like an omelet, or I'll do bacon and eggs, do like breakfasty tacos or a corned beef hash. Like the other day I had a brisket hash, right? So chopped up some of that brisket I smoked and chopped up some potatoes and had some eggs and basically made a brisket hash, which was delicious. But that's kind of where my breakfasty kind of thing lies. I kind of have breakfast, but it's almost always on the savory side, not the dessert for breakfast side of things. And I do it just much later in the day. So I either have a really late breakfast and skip lunch, or I skip breakfast and just have
so to the question of a balanced breakfast, you balance your breakfast on about 11, 11:30.
Right.
The hour of 11 or 11:30 and not on any food pyramid.
Yep.
Can we safely say that the breakfast foods are the best foods, though? Like, or is it just because that most people eat the first meal and they associate the first thing they have is the best, and over time you get used to having eggs and bacon in the morning, so you just associate that to be the best food?
I think that's the thing. Like, in a lot of cultures, there's not like a real separate like breakfast type of food. Like if you're in Japan, you don't really have breakfast foods, right? There's no like cereal isn't a big thing. Like often breakfast will be like,
I can get
a rice breakfast and a little bit of protein.
A small bowl of rice with some like fish, or actually one of my favorite things I've had in Tokyo was you get steamed rice, nice and hot, and you just like crack a raw egg into it and give it a really good mix. And the heat of the rice sort of cooks the egg into sort of almost a custardy kind of texture. So you have to be okay with like underdone egg kind of textures. But if you are, it's a pretty delicious way to start the day. And it's like some carbs from the rice, some protein from the egg. It's usually enough to keep you going.
The texture is pretty much just oatmeal.
Yeah, that's true.
And a really good, so I did that thing from a Just One Cookbook. She was talking about different dashi, the bonito, the fish stock that you use for almost everything. And she was saying that when you make dashi, take the seaweed and fish shavings from that and fry it in a pan with some soy sauce and sesame seeds and other stuff, and that's furikake. And furikake is like a great seasoning for other things. So you can throw that in on your tamago gohan, you can throw that in on a real simple stir fry, just furikake and rice.
Yeah.
All kind of stuff.
And that's really a pretty common thing you see at the poke places. They'll often have furikake as a topping option. And always, always get some. It's delicious.
You know, to this day, I've only ever had oatmeal once in my life, and that was not to eat it.
Would you stick it up your butt?
Well, in essence, because I had chicken pox, right? You like sit in the oatmeal bath or whatever it is.
Oh, if you say so.
Isn't it chicken pox? I forget what it was.
I'm learning. Oatmeal baths. Okay.
This is a thing that people do.
Right. Yeah, it's just to stop the itching, right? Because of the chicken pox when I was a kid. And then I guess like while I grew up, like I just never, I associated that with oatmeal. So I never just like, it was just never something I would eat. And to this day, I've never had any. Just doesn't seem appealing to me at all. Yeah.
So. You seem to have a lot of, and I don't want to go into details, you seem to have a lot of childhood trauma derived behaviors.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I was in a foreign country. I wasn't born here, and my parents didn't know social norms, so I didn't know what I was doing half the time. It's one reason why, you know, I am who I am.
I don't want to be for or against anything your parents have done. I'll just say that as somebody who grew up with strange parents, oatmeal baths are a thing. I don't know anyone who, because of oatmeal baths, doesn't eat oatmeal, aside from you, though, JJ. And I know more than one person who's had an oatmeal bath. I was really expecting you to say that they made it into like a paste and smeared it on you, but no, a bath.
Yeah.
How wasteful. It must just be drowning in oats over there in Asgard, yeah.
Asgard, if you will. Hey.
Asgard.
Hey. Yeah. 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 Come on. I've been waiting a while for that one.
Okay. Yeah. I'll buy it.
How do you read books these days? Do you like before Boom Boom Times, I'd really gotten into audiobooks because I was doing so much travel. And they seem to be the most conducive way to consume books while I was traveling. But now I'm not traveling. I can't like bring myself to listen to an audiobook. So I've kind of flipped back to ebooks and then the occasional actual physical book if the opportunity presents itself. I'm certainly not going out of my way to buy books made out of dead trees, but if I happen to get one for whatever reason. Like someone sent me a dead tree copy of that Shanta. Oh, now I'm not going to be pronouncing it.
Shantaram.
Shantaram. Which is a great book. But I read the sequel to that on ebook. And it was equally as pleasant on ebook as it was on a dead tree. I think the only thing I consume still in dead tree format is cookbooks. Mm. Everything else on ebooks or in past times, audiobooks. What about yourselves? Are you audiobooks? Are you ebooks? Are you dead trees? Or are you just don't read?
JJ?
Okay. So I've always had a problem with reading, just in general. It was a forced activity.
Did you have a bath in books?
Yeah, exactly. I covered myself in books every night in the bathtub just to be like, osmosis will make this work. No, but in all seriousness, I just reading and I never got along. I mean, granted, I read for my job because that's what development is and what our culture is we are constantly reading. But the idea of holding a book and reading has just never really appealed to me. Over time, I discovered audiobooks, and that's really how I get most of my information. I can absolutely not close my eyes, but sit on a couch, put some earbuds in or headphones on, and just listen to a book and lose myself completely into it and have hours just melt away. One reason why I love doing it while I was traveling is that basically, as soon as I walked into the airport, to the point where I got to my hotel room, I would have an audiobook or playing or something, and I would be so well entertained because I would get so into what was going on. Just a quick little antidote. I loved the Red Rising series by Pierce Brown, and I still remember one of the big plot points hitting when I was on the plane, and I actually grabbed my headphones and threw them on the ground saying, oh my God, I can't believe that just fucking happened. And people looked at me like I was crazy. And then I realized I got a little too deep into that series.
Right.
But yeah. So audiobooks for me.
Sean?
I have not been able to find a way to consistently listen to audiobooks or podcasts since I ceased commuting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I do find time for podcast consumption just because it's explicitly audio media. But for books, I went back to ebooks just because whatever concentration issues I have with like staying with one thing on the screen for however long that is, it's less than listening to audio and getting, you know, oh, this is a boring section, I'll go do something else or whatever. Like I don't have the same immersive experience that JJ.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. It's very easy for me to get distracted when I'm listening to an audiobook or a podcast, and then I'm like, oh shit, there's a thing happening in my ears that's been happening for ages. Now I need to go back and figure out the last point I was paying attention.
The rewind 15 seconds button when that showed up on podcast players was a blessing.
Right.
I'm jealous of you, JJ. I should make that clear.
I will say I am doing absolutely nothing else when I do listen to audiobooks. I cannot like fold laundry or whatever while listening to audiobooks because then I don't fully get immersed. When I drive though, when I used to drive to cities or whatever, I would actually look forward to the drive because my lizard brain would be doing the driving. Right? Because that's what happens when you get comfortable driving. And then I could consciously listen to the audiobook, and then the drive felt like it was like no time at all.
That it does bring up something interesting though. There was a you know, everybody finds out about things at once on the internet. So there was a thing going around where people are talking about how they don't have a visual part of their imagination. I forget the word for it, but.
Oh, they think in words versus pictures and vice versa.
Well, or yeah. Like when somebody says picture a beach, some people are able to close their eyes or not close their eyes and visually see a beach in their mind.
Really?
Right.
People can't do that.
People can't?
Yeah.
Yeah, people can't. There are people, I'm one of them, who have no capacity for the visual component of imagination.
Hmm.
And interestingly, it doesn't seem to affect spatial reasoning, like dramatically in one way or the other. It doesn't affect, you know, all kinds of other things, but because as you live, you develop, you know, some kind of coping mechanism for the stuff. Like literally you get asked to do that kind of stuff all the time. Oh, imagine this, immerse yourself in this story or whatever. But yeah, plenty of people who don't have that visual component of their imagination. And there's other stuff like that too, yeah. Where something that you would consider natural and universal isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, that was actually going to be my question is, Paul, do you have that capacity? And it sounds like you do.
I'm trying to figure that out.
I'm
on the fence. Like I just closed my eyes and tried to visualize a beach and couldn't, but I do have I have daydreams where I see things. I have, I definitely am able to produce images in my mind, but like just closing my eyes and trying to visualize a beach a second ago, I didn't see a beach. I couldn't.
So you're like the dude from
I can think about a beach and I can think about what would be happening at the beach. Like, there would be people in their Speedos, there'd be people surfing, there would be people building sandcastles. But actually constructing that image in my head, I'm not sure I can. I'm going to have to do some practice and see if it's just because I'm on the spot, I'm not doing it, or if I actually can't do it.
I'll send you a link, but it's Aphantasia.
I immediately saw the Corona beach in my head.
So I can see that, but that's because I've seen photos of it. So I can bring up like a memory of that, seeing the photo of it.
Oh, interesting. I don't know if
it's the same thing.
Oh. Well, I guess just say influenced. I can see it influenced by
the Corona.
I can
think about the thing that you're talking about, but I can't. I have no capacity for a visual component of that. However, I was able to see the image of the coronavirus molecule when you said the Corona beach. So I don't know. I'm not entirely aphantasic.
Now, is there a test? I would assume it's one of those things where there's a spectrum. It's not like a on off. It's like probably a fairly lengthy spectrum of abilities. I wonder if there's a test you can do that tells you like where on that you live.
Maybe we just need to take Sean to a beach. Maybe he's just never been to a beach. It could be that.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Now on that,
is this a cry for help, Sean? Is this a cry for help?
I refuse to answer this question on the grounds that it might keep me from going to the beach.
In that same realm of things, do you all have an inner monologue? Like, do you talk to yourself inside your own head?
I both inside and out.
Right, for sure. Sean?
Yes, I do have an inner monologue.
Well, I think you would almost have to, since you don't have the visual. It's probably almost like there wouldn't be much going on in your brain if you didn't have visual or inner monologue.
Just no, but there is definitely a way. Like, you can think of things without having your own voice inside your head saying,
sure,
Paul, you are thinking of an egg frying in a pan.
Right. But like there are people that have no inner monologue and that don't have conversations with themselves. And so I think that was probably discussed. It was, I feel like, about a month ago. So probably about the same time your stuff was being talked about, Sean. So I'm sure they were related in the discussions.
It's because we're all isolated. Yeah. It's because we're all isolated. Now we have time to think about these things.
Right. Deep thoughts.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I guess we're coming up to a good time to, I guess, saying deep thoughts at the end of a conversation is probably a good time to wrap this up.
Yeah.
So, any last thoughts?
Any last thoughts? Golly, that's free form.
Yeah, it is.
Isn't the Coté thing that there's supposed to be a gimmick at the end of any Coté associated?
Yeah, our gimmick is that we don't have a gimmick.
Yeah. Okay. It's just rambly thoughts. That's literally it is.
We've tried to do a few gimmicks and we just we are unable to remain consistent on anything is our problem.
Well, actually, no, that's not 100% true. Paul has been on every single one of the podcasts since we got it off of the ground again. Every single one of them.
I guess I have. I'm not sure that's something to be proud of. I don't know if that tells me something negative about my life or positive about my life.
It's consistency. It's important. It's important.
Oh, that was important. I did actually have a thought, and it's it may have been after I listened to the first one of these. Coté mentioned something about this was a surprise to me when he was talking about it. But he has a deep fear of failure. Like, that his introversion is characterized by a deep fear of failure. And I was thinking about that, like, for myself. You know, I feel like I am introverted, but somehow I've been able to get over my fear of failure in a way that's like, oh, I'm going to be a clown in front of people, you know, and
oh yeah,
the failure is part of my learning experience and their learning experience. And the reason that I thought of that was, you know, it's on the podcast now, is JJ, myself, and Mr. Clown Shoes. clownshoe.es or whatever. But like, it's interesting how the story that you tell yourself to keep from doing something is like, is so, such a big, it can become such a big part of what you think of as your personality, and yet mm-hmm. not an impediment to you at all, mm-hmm. right? Like, Cote is just the most prolific podcaster out of anybody ever. And I think a lot of people.
Is that because he turned podcasting into the place where he allowed himself to be free of failure? Or free of the fear of failure? So like podcasting a coping mechanism in the same way that you putting on your clown hat is a coping mechanism?
Yeah.
Well, you've talked in the past, JJ, about using it as a learning experience because you get somebody who knows the thing to tell you how to do the thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And like there's definitely utility in showing your vulnerability mm-hmm. in front of people, both as a learning tool but also as a promotion tool too, right? Like mm-hmm. it's inspiring to see somebody show vulnerability. This is the worst final thought.
Yeah, what's going on?
I'm sorry.
I think
I was supposed to say something witty. I don't have anything witty to say. Good. I don't belong here.
Wow. We were asking first. I guess we did say deep thoughts, so we got a deep thought. So you did produce what was requested.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you. I actually appreciate what you just said. Mm-hmm. All jokes aside.
Yes. Same here. Here.
We're all here because we're not all there.
There you go.
Oh, there's the perfect ending right there.